House Intercommittee on Human Services and Housing on Tuesday, September 17, 2013. We'll have an organizational meeting on the adoption of committee rules. These are the rules that were sent to you earlier by email, and they are the same that we've had in the interim before. Any questions or concerns about these? All right.
About the hours of the committee meeting?
I don't think it does that. Sorry.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed interim committee rules dated today, September 17th, 2013.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So adopted. Thank you. We'll have an informational hearing on the Early Learning Council, the Transition Integration Update. Jada, good to see you. And Mr. Saxton, glad you're here. Oh, you're coming up too? We're always happy to have a threesome. Terrific.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Rob Saxton, I'm Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state. Nice to be here this morning and see everybody. I haven't been in front of this committee before, I don't think.
It's a rough committee.
Yes, I'm sure it is. I do think that there are people on the committee though who are probably tired of seeing me over the last couple of days, so they had an hour of me yesterday. We're here to talk about the transition, really, of two parts into the Oregon Department of Education, and so that's why I asked Iris to join us here, too. One is the Early Learning Council and then the Youth Development Council, or Youth, Early Learning Division and Youth Development Division, and the two bills that move those, that combination forward out of the last session, 3234, which brought the Early Learning Council into a component of the Department of Education, and then 3231, which brought youth development into the Department of Education, really made the department a P through 12 department, and thinking about how to coordinate that work. And so there are a couple really nice things about that. One is that the back office function piece that comes along with that makes us more efficient, so things like procurement, HR, payroll, and assessment are all parts of both of these groups, and so we are able to combine some of our staff and be more efficient in the work that we do. But more importantly, really, is that we need to be bigger than the sum of our previous parts, that we work together in a different way, and that we're able to actually deliver more coordinated services on behalf of the students and the children in the state of Oregon. And so we've been working on that since early last spring, when we thought that these bills had a strong chance of passing. There's been a lot of support from across the state. I'd like to really commend the Department of Administrative Services for some of the early supports that they gave us, and in fact, they're still continuing to give us some supports around procurement, especially around the hubs, but we're transitioning all that into the department. And one of the things that we're working on very closely is to make sure that we coordinate services and give better services to children and students in the state, while at the same time still maintaining within one organization a little bit of autonomy, so that people clearly understand this is, you know, early childhood, and clearly understand this is youth development, and so that the communities understand that in a specific way as well, because there's support for those communities across the state. So it's a very interesting and fun piece of work, and I'm sure that we're going to be able to coordinate our services in a way that meet the needs of our citizens and with improved services. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jada, who's going to talk about a couple things that we have done that I think are representative of how we've become bigger than the sum of our parts.
Do you have any questions before we start?
Yes, or if you have any questions, certainly.
Any questions for Mr. Saxton? Yes, Representative Wissett.
Thank you, Dr. Saxton. I don't understand. I was out of the Human Services Education for two sessions. How is the budgeting for the Early Learning Council division? Is that all that money going to come to you or to Dr. Golden? Can you parse it out, or the legislature, will we approve a budget for the Youth Development Council and a budget for Early Learning Division?
Chair Tomei,
Committee Representative Wisnett. My name is Jada Rupley. I'm the Early Learning System Director. The answer, Representative Wisnett, to that question is we continue with our separate budgets. What we have combined together are the services in the back office, the shared services. So we all receive our services from those same budget elements at the department. So my budget, for example, has been approved by the council as well as you last session, but then the actual work takes place through the financial services.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
So you're saying we're going to approve a budget, or the budget will be submitted by you to the council, to us, but we'll approve it for the division?
Yeah. In other words, I think what you're asking is, will we continue to have some kind of continuity and separateness from the Department of Education budget? And the answer, I believe, is yes to that. That's how we all understand it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Chair Tomei. And committee members, I'm Jada Rupley. I wanted to take you back on a little journey. My very first committee that I came in front of in Oregon last year at this time was you. And so I'm very excited about talking to you about some of the work that we've done. At this time, when I came last year, you had passed some landmark legislation with both Senate Bill 909 as well as the early learning version of 4165. And it was really creating a way to do business differently in Oregon education, to look at some of the things that you knew that you wanted to change. So I had two charges, and those charges were, one, to begin implementation of a system, to redesign the early learning system, and the second was to move from the governor's office to the Department of Education, both easy tasks on any given day or not. So with that, I want to do my thank yous also to the Department of Education, because they have had considerable additional work to be able to do, as well as to the governor's office and the Department of Administrative Services, because we started that transition last February in the hopes that we could make this a smooth transition to do. And so on the internal side, everyone's paychecks transferred over, all of those kinds of things that are unique and special to you, Oregon State Government. It's been a fairly seamless and smooth system. I'm sure that the people who have been doing the work may not say that, because they're looking pretty ragged and tired, but we did accomplish that. So with that, we also combined, as you know, program from the Department of Employment, as well as some of the programs in the internal part of ODE, as well as the Early Learning Council and our staff. And at the same time, we were growing. So last year, you had Duke Shepherd and myself here, and today we have several people doing the work that you have tasked us to do. So I wanted to talk a little bit about a folder that you have in front of you, and it's a manila folder, and we talk about the investing in early childhood. And if you look, I'm going to revisit the problem a little bit, and that problem is, again, that 45,000 children every year are born poor. They are Medicaid eligible. You have 40% of them that arrive at kindergarten not ready to begin their school education. And by third grade, we have 41% of them that are continuing to not read at grade level. And following all that way is also Oregon high school students don't graduate. So we need to look at a system that's an outcome-based system to be able to address. And so last session, you did House Bill 2013, which further redesigned the investments in early learning. So you'll often hear in education about the strategic investments, and House Bill 2013 is that strategic investment in early learning. We landed on the word hubs because it was easier to pronounce than many of the other titles that we had moving forward in terms of early learning system design managers and a number of other things. And in that legislation, you directed us to create over this biennium up to 16 hubs and no more than up to 7 this first year. The outcomes that we're looking at addressing are, again, that children are ready for kindergarten and they're a part of a stable and attached family and a more coordinated system. And as you look, and you've heard from me in the past, you know that this is a bridge that we start at healthcare, working with their providers as well as many of the programs that the coordinated care organizations. And so we share some joint outcomes with the CCOs that we will be looking at in terms of early screening. We also just returned from a road trip on the competition for the first up to seven hubs. We went to Medford, we went to Bend, we went to Portland and Pendleton, and listened to feedback on this application that we have put together since you left the session in mid-July, and have put out. We were very careful to listen very carefully as we went out, because sometimes when you're sitting here writing it and you're up to your elbows in the words of hubs and all the legislation, we forget that part of the community that we want to make sure and address. Because if you remember, this is really a community base. We have these communities out there addressing the fact that they want results-based education for kindergartners as they come to school. So what we found is a series of concerns, questions that we addressed in our portal, which we have out on the application. So all questions are addressed in there, and if anyone would like to look and see what those questions are, I'd be glad to give you that link. There are 95 questions. So in your packets in front of you, one of the things that I wanted to point out is, first of all, we have one of the elements of your letter, so in your area, so you can look to see who those hub applicants are. We received 19 letters of application. It's the very back. And in those 19 letters of community interest, what we found is every county in the state of Oregon was covered. And in a couple places, a couple counties were covered more than once. So that tells you that there's still community work that needs to be accomplished. What this is, in this redesign of looking at the hubs and the application, is this is not about programs and children and services. Those services stayed the same at your direction through House Bill 2013. So all of the Oregon pre-K kindergarten programs, the home visiting programs, and the programs that were issued through the counties continued through July 1 of 2014. The relief nurseries also. So all of those programs that directly serve children are continued to serve children. What this redesign is really looking at is an infrastructure for communities to look at how they share those services together and reach the result that we don't have 4 out of 10 children that are not ready for kindergarten when they walk through the doors of school. One of the other things that I wanted to real quickly show you is that with the race to the top, one of the which race to the top again is the $20 million that Oregon won for the early learning system to be able to change the system, added by another $10 million that happened last spring. And one of the first wins that we see together with the Department of Education was the kindergarten assessment. It was started by the Early Learning Council and the staff and did a pilot. We took the pilot results, made changes, and then the Department of Ed, in a joint effort, picked this effort up. They worked with the state board to be able to create the necessary guidelines for moving forward, and every kindergartner this fall is taking that very brief snapshot test. Not high-stakes testing. It takes less than 15 minutes to be able to do, and it also includes probably the most important part is an observation by the kindergarten teacher of each one of those children in the first 4 weeks of school, looking at their behaviors, looking at their social-emotional readiness to be at school. So there's a little bit of literacy, there's a little bit of numeracy, but there's a month-long worth of welcoming by that teacher as they observe and look at that child coming to school. So I'd like to quit and answer any questions that you might have for me.
Yes, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you so much for all the work that you've been doing. I know it's been a really fast journey. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the changes that you made as a result of the pilots in the kindergarten readiness? And also, I know we had a couple $1 million in that bill to try to help the schools adjust to this new kindergarten readiness, and I'm wondering how you're using that and what kind of support the kindergarten teachers have as they try to spend 15 minutes with each child. I know a lot of them have 30 kids in the classroom.
Representative Kenny Geyer, yes. The changes that we made after the initial pilot were eliminating a couple of items, also taking some revisions to that, because what we did is we did an assessment as well as an evaluation that was funded by the Ford Foundation and looked at not only our process but several of those items. This year rolling out is the changes and the modifications to that, which is, again, this statewide field test. So we went from pilot mode to this. We eliminated a math. Basically, no kids scored on that. We also looked at revising a couple of the vocabulary words that we had put in there that they were too hard to be able to do. So in the process, there is a position that is funded through the Race to the Top, and I'm going to let Deputy Superintendent Saxon talk a little bit more about the other money, but we have a program then that was training to get ready for the kindergarten assessment, spent all spring working with school districts to be able to do that, and actually all the way through summer until they were beginning to do that. We also worked significantly on the test changes to be able to do and put that system into play. That actually is your system that you can talk about in terms of how you deliver assessments to the schools.
So, Chair Kamei, Representative Kenny Geyer, my understanding with the funds is that it was about the training that we provided to the kindergarten teachers about what that looked like, and we did that last spring and then a little bit as we headed into the fall, so paying for the time of the teachers and so forth. And then there also is a considerable amount of time if you think about 15 minutes in assessments, 15 to 18 minutes, and then, you know, meeting with each child and doing that work and then working through the results. So, and then the time also to do the observation and fill all that out, so we've paid for those for that time to districts to make sure that we're able to get that done without additional workload. It's additional workload, but for additional compensation.
And so there's people coming in to help the kindergarten teachers during that time?
So
I'm assuming that's like an extra 30 hours during that four-week period.
Correct.
If you think about the 15 minutes and then assessing and then giving the feedback to if they're engaging parents in any way.
Sure. And so the funds went to school districts, and then school districts worked through how that was going to be delivered specifically with their teachers and with their representatives. Right. And then there was no single methodology for that distribution. It went to districts, and then they worked through how they were going to make that all come together.
Okay, and follow-up?
Yes.
Do you have a system in place to get feedback from the school districts on how that's going, both the training, because I've heard some feedback that I passed on to Jada about the PowerPoint that was used, but also the whole process. Is there a way that districts are feeding the information back to you about how that's going?
Yeah, Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes. At the end of this, when we're done, we have a survey that's ready to go out to the field so we can get some feedback. I also have been out in school districts, and I was just in Klamath Falls last week and met with all the kindergarten teachers in the district after they had done the numeracy and literacy part of the assessment to get some feedback about that. They've not yet filled out the parts around, you know, sort of the student behaviors, but lots of really good feedback from a group of room full of kindergarten teachers who wanted me to know what that was like, and what they really said was that there were some students who were able to do very well on the assessment and others who could hardly do anything on the assessment, and it was fairly clear about who was kindergarten ready and who was not, which is what we're looking for. There are parts of the way that some districts are implementing the assessment that are local decisions. And so part of the work that I had to do with that group was talk about, okay, so is this a local decision or is this something that was already expectations. So the local decision there was that the first interaction really was around this assessment. And I don't think that the kindergarten teachers appreciated that particularly, that the first interaction I'm going to have with a kindergartner is me sitting down and asking them a series of questions about what they know and what they don't know as compared to something that might be a little more welcoming. And so I encourage them to think about their practice there as they move forward with that, and to get a couple days under their belt perhaps with some of the welcoming activities before they engage in that kind of an assessment. But so getting separating that out, is this local or is this a requirement of the assessment, will be important as well.
I'm feeling concerned about that too. I just was doing the math, and I think we're talking about 8 to 10 hours that would be required by each kindergarten teacher, especially ones who have 30 kids. I mean, that's a big chunk of time. And what period of time would they be expected to do this evaluation?
So the overall evaluation, the expectation is to have it done over the course of the first 6 weeks. So that they have additional time to look at the behavioral part. But the literacy and numeracy, we want to have that assessment done fairly quickly, because what we want to know is how did this child arrive, not what have you taught them in the intervening time since they did arrive. And so we'd like to have that done in the first couple of weeks for sure, and that's how we're encouraging them to do that. I do think that we need to have some discussion, and I know that locally, the kindergarten teachers in Klamath Falls, for example, were giving their curriculum director, because he was there with me, some real direct feedback about they actually had come together and helped design how they were going to deliver this, and they thought it sounded like a good plan.
Kindergarten
and a good
teachers
idea.
Came directly, or the curriculum?
The kindergarten teachers directly had given input about how to do this or how they intended to do it in Klamath Falls. After they did it, they said, you know, we probably could have done this a little bit differently. Let's talk about it, and let's do this a little differently locally next year. And then we have some suggestions for the state as well. But we'll collect that up in mass once this is done and look at ways we might be able to improve it as we move forward. It's also really important that we're able to take these results and use them as a baseline. Mm-hmm. So we need to be really thoughtful about any changes that we're going to make so that we don't change it so much, you know, that we don't have data that tells us something over time about the kinds of changes that are going to take place in the early childhood system that we believe are going to change the outcomes around kindergarten readiness when they arrive. And so we want to make sure that we're continuing to see what happens there, and that this gives us a result so that we know when we're making progress. So it's that balance.
I know the education committee also would like continuing feedback on how this is working out. I'd really like to hear more from kindergarten teachers if this feels like a burden to them. And since they didn't ask for this, it was sort of the legislature that came upon this idea, and we're putting more of an unfunded mandate on them again. And I'd like to get feedback. We know with the long-term plan is going to be beneficial for these children.
Right.
In the meantime, I think the teachers have a burden. It sounds like they have a burden. I'm not on the education committee, but I hope that we seek in the education committee feedback from folks on how that is working for the teachers as well as for the kids.
And Chair Tomei, I absolutely agree, and I know that it's additional work for kindergarten teachers.
No.
And as a district superintendent just a year ago, and I looked at the pilot, and we piloted one of the assessments last year so that we would be aware of what that looked like, so we could give some feedback before the actual assessment was done statewide. One of the things that some districts have done and some have not is to give all students a kindergarten readiness assessment or a kindergarten assessment when they do arrive. In the Tiger-Tualatin School District, we did. And the reason was because we wanted to know where that child sat the day that they arrived so that the teacher could have the best knowledge possible about how to move their learning forward in a personalized way. That's a really important consideration. So one of the things that we had to think about as a district was, can we stop doing the assessment that we used to do with those students so that we can figure out how to move them forward and use this now as the assessment so that it is not additional work for our kindergarten teachers? If we continue to do both, it definitely is different work. And I heard the folks in Klamath Falls talking about that as well. There are many places, unfortunately, across the state where kindergartners would arrive and they did not do an assessment. And I think that is a really big mistake, because it doesn't give them the information they need to be able to move forward with students in the best way. And so I do think it's a benefit not only for the state, but also locally, and districts are going to have to figure out how to use this assessment in a way that perhaps they don't have to double test. I think that's where there'd be a really big resource drain.
Thank you. So, yes, Representative Kenny Geyer, and then we'll go to Representative Whitman.
So I thank you for all that, and I'm sure you're very aware of all the kind of concerns. You know, I've heard a little bit of them. You've heard a lot more just in how the assessment happens. I'm a huge believer in doing some kind of assessment, but also the way the information is collected, whether that is supported with adequate training so that they don't make kids feel bad if they don't know how to do it, how that information is given back to parents, whether they have the support so that they're not trying to do, I think of it as almost 30 hours as opposed to 8 hours if you do beyond just the 15-minute sit-down with the child. And so I'm very curious about how that's all going, and we need to hear the feedback about whether we're just passing on more unfunded mandates or what is it, the support that you need to make this happen in the best way. And along with that, also, there's been a big concern about what do you do with non-native English speakers who come in, or how do you account for cultural differences in the testing. So I'm a little curious about what you've been finding so far and how you've addressed that in your initial round.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. Those are some things that we'll be looking at this fall. The kindergarten assessment is not completed in many of the districts that they're there. I know that some of the initial training looked at those differences to make sure to address children with disabilities as well as our non-English speakers. And so I think that we'll only get better at that as we take a look at it to see and get the feedback.
Representative Lissnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jada, thank you and your team for coming to Ben. I was able to attend the briefing on the RFP. The question by people that were going to be part of the hub were about counting at-risk kids, and you said you'd pick that up at other locations, too. Have you had a meeting or determined yet whether prenatal will count or how that's going to be counted, because that'll be the bottom line again for money?
Chair Tomei and Representative Wisnett, if you remember that many of our programs in the home visiting area do serve families prenatal, what we're looking at is the infrastructure dollars, and so we are focusing on that population that are starting at birth to kindergarten, so through six. So we do not address those prenatal moms in that, but I will say this, is our programs do address and serve prenatal moms.
Follow up. I think I told you at that meeting, I disagree with that. I think if the mother's not healthy and doesn't deliver a healthy baby, then you're going to have, society's going to have a lot more difficulty. And the Commission on Children and Families did address prenatal.
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, I totally agree with you, Representative.
So do I. Okay, any other questions? We're glad you can make it, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Okay, great. We're glad you're here.
Mm-hmm. I went to the one.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Director of the Youth Development Council. I'm going to sort of take you back through a little bit of the background around the council. You know, it was formed and created out of House Bill 4165 to support the Oregon Education Investment Board. And then House Bill 3231 transitioned us over to the Department of Ed. I and my staff, we're not new to transition. We've been transitioning now for a number of years. We transitioned out of the commission system over to the governor's office, and now we're transitioning out of the governor's office over to the Department of Ed. That's been a rather seamless transition because we've had support from Dr. Saxton and his staff and his management team. In fact, we have been attending and sitting in on his management team meetings, and so that has really led to a rather smooth transition because we're sitting there with his leadership, understanding and beginning to learn the processes and methodologies and procedures of the Department of Ed. So being there at the management team meetings of Dr. Saxon has been very, very helpful with respect to the transition. We've also began to incorporate components of ODE's strategic plan into our YDD strategic plan. And in doing that, we've been able to see where that continuity and alignment, which is called out in 4165, actually is taking place. And I have some examples of that. For example, we meet now, and we've been meeting with some of the divisions in the Department of Ed around things like suspension, expulsion, and that has really, really allowed us then to take a look at the mission that we have around that continuity. For example, as we've been talking to the discipline, suspension, and expulsion folks in the Department of Ed, we've also been talking to the Youth Authority, Oregon Youth Authority, because we know about that school-to-prison pipeline, and if we're going to ever impact that, we have to have various agencies and state government talking to each other along that continuum. And so that kind of transitioning, which was really called for in our legislation, is beginning to take place, and I'm very, very happy with the kinds of discussions that are actually taking place. Another example of that is our homeless and runaway youth system. As you know, the homeless and runaway youth system was with the commission, but then it transitioned over to the Department of Human Services. With that transition, as we entered into the Department of Ed, we also know that there's a homeless youth education program at the Department of Ed. So here you have these two departments, both with components of work around homeless youth. And so what we've been able to do is bring those two components together as well to discuss what needs to happen and take place. We have 8 sites operating around the state right now with the homeless and runaway youth system out of the Department of Human Services. And then we have these liaisons over at the Department of Education. So what we're starting to do now is to couple and, again, look for that alignment and that continuity in the transition, having some very good discussions about how the liaisons can support the 8 sites that are over at the Department of Human Services. So kind of having that background knowledge of systems coming out of the commission system itself and being able to align and link these kinds of services really does look at the efficiency of our systems in state government and looks at how we can get better outcomes for young folks. And so that's happening as we're able to gain access and have those conversations within the Department of Ed, and then as we're able to reach back to our old partners that are over at the Department of Human Services, the ones that are over at the Youth Authority as well. So that kind of alignment is the kind of alignment that we've been working on. With respect to our other components of our action plan, we have a strategic action plan. And with respect to that plan, as we take, again, we're still continuing to look at what's happening within the context of the Department of Ed, that sort of complements our plan around parenting, around mentoring, around juvenile justice, around gang prevention intervention, and even after looking at before and after school programs. How do those particular functions that we've kind of called out, how are those operating within the context of the Department of Ed and how we're aligning those kinds of programs? So in some areas, we're seeing a lot of continuity. We're seeing how we can insert ourselves in with our particular strategic plan. In other areas, we're still trying to identify how that can work. Another piece of our legislation called for us to engage community. And so we have as well been out on the road engaging community. We've been over 30 communities to date with an agenda now that stretches out into November with visits to communities to talk about how we should be engaging young folks, how we engage parents, how we engage the community providers, and how we get that feedback. As you know, we've been asked to put together a funding plan for how we fund our system moving forward in July 2014. Right now, we continue to fund the systems and the programs that were in place through the old commission system for one more year. And after that year, we are to then transition those fundings to a new funding plan in order to best meet the needs of communities. And so we've been out in the community talking to community members about what they think ought to be funded, what kinds of systems we ought to use to do that funding. And so that's where we've been. That's our transition. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Ms. Bell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sachs, you must be. I hope you're enjoying your job. It looks like a difficult job you're taking on. Youth gang and prevention. Do you have experience in that, or do you have staff in that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett. Well, my answer would just be yes. So, personal experience. Yeah,
it's a difficult.
Absolutely.
I
would like to think about my time as an assistant principal in the high school in Albany, West Albany High School, and thinking about gang and gang prevention back in the day. Just a little bit of that, but as a district superintendent, yes, and in the department as well. So we've had efforts in the department that are around behavior, around gang activity, around prevention, and then also, the disproportionate discipline that we see for our students of color in particular, that really lead to the, prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. And then there is the Youth Development Council or Youth Development Division who now comes in with additional expertise and additional program around that. And so now we need to tie those two together and create something better than what we've had previously. Mm-hmm. As a superintendent in a district, I was always looking for all the help that we could get from that and working with the department. And this partnership and this change, I think, really ties some pieces together that we haven't seen previously.
Yes, sir. Can I add a little to that? Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett. Another piece of this, we've been working with the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, which is in the department, and that is the office where the whole discipline, suspension, and expulsion data and information is shared. And so we know, and what we know is that if kids are not in school and not learning, and we've had a disproportionate number of those young folks who have been either suspended or expelled from school, they tend to get involved in other activities outside of the school setting. And one of those is getting involved in gangs. So our ability to begin to monitor what is happening around suspensions and expulsions, and we had a House Bill 2192 that really began to take a look at and give school districts more discretion in how they determine who gets suspended or expelled. That particular, the ability to align that with the work that we're trying to do with gangs is really, really very informative.
Director Bell and Dr. Mm-hmm. Saxon, this bill has a lot of money, extra money in it for gang balance. And I hope we're not just monitoring, I hope we're preventing.
Oh, no.
Let's don't spend all our time looking for data, let's go solve the problems. I hope you succeed. I just had my tires slashed in Northeast Portland, so there was 100 reports of people's tires being slashed. So, it's a strange mix for me, for education and gang balance. So wish you luck.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from the Oregon Housing and Community Services Transitions Plan Update with Margaret Van Vliet. Welcome again, Margaret.
I heard
Chrissy, it's nice to have you back.
The car was parked in my mother-in-law's.
If you have these from housing, you have these at your desk. Okay, Margaret, thank you.
Okay, good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services, and I'm really happy to be here this morning to give you an update. on our transition planning effort and to get any comments or feedback from you at this point in our process. I'll start by just affirming that we are on schedule. I've been talking to you about our schedule since we began this journey, and I want to affirm that we are on target to bring a plan back to the legislative session in February. You'll recall we really started this journey when the governor released a budget last December that called for change in the programs and services that are currently delivered by Oregon Housing and Community Services. And there were several drivers for that, but the call to action was pretty strong and included the recommendation for just 1 year of funding in the biennium while we did this important planning work. The legislatively adopted budget for my agency really echoed that and affirmed those assumptions and said, yeah, let's really take a deep look. And so we have a budget for half the biennium, with a budget note that really echoes the call for change. You'll recall that we run suites of programs that really run a continuum and include multifamily rental development, things we call safety net, which is really includes food, emergency housing assistance, bill payment assistance, really emergency and safety net kinds of services. We do administer energy and weatherization programs. We provide single-family financing and foreclosure prevention, and some other related services as well. So we have a very broad reach that spans 49 programs and some 64 funding sources. The other sort of context for this work is really a deep dive in what is the role of state government in this service delivery system. You've seen this slide before, and I think it's important to sort of bring us back here, that we receive lots of streams of money from the federal government and from state resources. Our job in the middle is really to package those and then distribute them out to local partners who do the work on the ground. So in other words, we don't do direct service delivery at Oregon Housing and Community Services. We don't own any real estate. We're nobody's landlord. We don't have caseworkers. All of our work is done through local partners. And with the affordable housing resources, in many ways, we act like a bank, a public bank. We package things that amount to real estate development resources. And the other side of the house is we package community services funding, and we perform very much like a typical grants administration operation. Again, packaging federal and state resources and redistributing them back out to local partners. And it's important because as we think about service delivery model, for me it's really about what's the appropriate and most helpful role for state government, because it's the local actors who really make the impact on the ground. So we're taking a deep look at questions around that. I've talked to you a number of times about sort of the challenges that we face with that role sort of in the middle, if you will. And so some of these will be familiar to you. I would characterize it as largely having to do with the fact that in many ways the department, for good reason, has operated historically in a silo, that we you sort of operate these programs independently and not necessarily in alignment with other things happening in state government. We've also talked about the fact that we have 8, and now it's actually 10, statutorily named advisory bodies who advise on different streams of funding and different housing issues, farm worker housing, for example, energy conservation in housing, homelessness issues. So there's a diffuse sort of policy setting construct that has really served to sort of hamper our efforts over the years. Other issues that we want to address through this process is really a balance of, call it control, decision making, a bias towards what we see in Salem as the right answer, as opposed to really giving deference to what local communities think are their priorities and how they want to go about solving them. So there's any number of issues that I think we have the opportunity to address with this transition planning process. And so based on that analysis and lots of conversation and engagement with our stakeholders, those local partners who do the work for us, we've developed some themes about what we think the future state really could look like and should look like if we do this work well. Since we started in earnest early in this calendar year, we've had a lot of conversation, a lot of engagement with those local partners. Many of them have written to us about what they see as their guiding principles, if you will, the things they really want to see out of the system. It all, of course, boils down to we want to serve more low-income people better. We want to move people along the path to self-sufficiency, whatever that means to them.
Sure. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you, but
no problem.
Can you describe the those stakeholder who they were and maybe even the structure, the agenda for the meetings? I mean, how did that process unfold?
Yes, absolutely. Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos, there are organized groups of stakeholders who already sort of come together and talk about policy issues. For example, the Oregon Opportunity Network, the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, the Oregon Housing Authorities, the Housing Alliance. And so we've really tapped into those existing structures, and I've been at many, many meetings with them over the course of time. In a minute, I'll talk to you about how we're taking their good input and putting it into a structured way of gathering and then creating what we call scenarios. So if I can get to that in a minute,
thank you.
That would be great. But there are existing structures in addition to the eight bodies that advise the department, which I'm regularly in front of most of those. So we'll take any opportunity to talk to folks and listen to their perspective. A couple other things I would just call out on this kind of desired future state. This piece about really local capacity, really helping local and regional groups. Some are very well positioned to articulate their priorities and think about what their solutions would be. Others, not so much. And so we really want to encourage local capacity to develop their own solutions and come together about their thinking about their priorities. In some places, again, we know that that's, for example, farm worker housing. We know, for example, some communities are particularly interested in housing that helps elders age in place and have health supports. Other places, they're pretty focused on family reunification or unification. And so we're trying to sort of get to a place where locals are supported to bring forward their priorities and that the state is better positioned to respond to what those priorities are.
Margaret, in your materials here, you mentioned in that same category, achieve specified state policy outcomes. So what do we have that in print somewhere that we know what the state policy outcomes are?
Chair Tomei, that's a great question, and the answer is no, we really don't. And I think that this is an opportunity for us to step back and think about what are our interests when it comes to housing and safety net services, and broadly say, here's the outcomes we want. Now, locals, you tell us how you can get there. It's very diffuse right now.
Who will come up with those very specific outcomes?
Chair Tomei, I think there's any number of possibilities right now. Again, these eight bodies give their perspective, and then this organized stakeholder groups also have priorities. I think one of the things that I want to come back to you with in February is some notions about what would be a more rational policy setting construct to guide these investments. You know, I've talked about the fact that we lack, you know, a North Star. There's lots of people with individual priorities. And if the state can say, here's our overarching priorities, and again, let the locals come forward and say, well, here's how we would use your resources to meet those priorities. It's that balance between sort of having ceding all control. It's not, I've said to some folks, that we want to just turn over the checkbook and let communities do whatever they want, because we do know that in some places, not all communities actually want affordable rental housing, for example. So we can't just cede all sort of control. That said, I think we can get out of the way a little bit more. And I think we need a construct. And I think this process is going to lead me to some recommendations that we'll be able to talk about in the February session about how could we move forward.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, and just to submit, because we just heard from the Early Learning Council. And so their overarching goal is to make sure that every child is kindergarten ready at age five. So that's sort of, we all came up, that's a common goal.
Correct.
And this is not what I'm seeing here.
Right.
There are at least 8-10 different programs or committees or whatever that meet together. And each of these could be totally different.
Right.
So it seems to me that what we need and what we're missing here is one statewide policy. I mean, and that's sort of what you've stated here.
Yes.
But I'm not sure going through this process, because each of these 10 groups of people is going to say our goal is the best.
Chair Tomei, I think we're in a place where people are recognizing that the diffuse interests and goals sometimes are complementary, sometimes they're competing. I think in my conversations with these stakeholders over the past several months, I actually believe that they're coming to recognize we do need to create some construct. It shouldn't come from me, right? But we should create some construct that provides the venue for the good conversation about these should be our priorities when it comes to affordable housing.
So you're thinking that these
we need to create something.
We'll come up with that.
I think so.
Is that what your goal
is? I think so. I think as I'm putting forward the questions and going into these next phases in the fall, which I'll show you in a minute, kind of what the work is over the next 6 to 8 weeks, I think those themes will very much come out of that, and then it'll be my job to package that and bring it forward to you for your sort of consideration.
Will this committee make that decision? Is it the governor who's going to make that decision? Who will make that decision that this will be the state policy?
I think it will have to be a combination, truthfully. I am obligated to, of course, report to the governor my recommendations, and he's made it very clear that I will then forward those recommendations once he's signed off on them to the legislature. And so I think we'll want to continue to have conversations this fall and before we get to February about, sort of what are the roles of the different branches, if you will. So I think we're going to see consensus from the system that change needs to happen, and I'll do my best to put forward what I think makes sense, having listened to everybody. I think in the executive branch, there's a lot that could be done just through different organizational structures, but we very much want to have it be informed by and understood and embraced by this body and all the stakeholders.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No problem. That was interesting. Yesterday, during our conversation with you and Rem, and I had asked them to come in, and we had some conversation regarding the Albany Helping Hands situation down there for expanding and building. And we were discussing the issue around the area of available funding and also the mechanism on how you pursue that. It must be two different things. That's the only thing I can think of here, because the chair just brought up the idea about not having specified state policy outcomes that you want to develop. But I got to think that you have some measurement in place in order to disperse the dollars when you have a bunch of applications coming in seeking those dollars.
Right. So, Chair Tomei and Representative Olson, so we do have some existing policy guidelines and priorities for individual streams of funds. And so the funds that you and I talked about yesterday that the local nonprofit would come in and compete for has, you know, a set of constructs and some policy guidance around it that's been developed over the years. So that's still in place, and my hope is that through the course of this project, we get to a place where the policy that guides that, for example, tax credit or development grant is tied to the bigger agenda, and that we know that our overall agenda is more people have stable housing and we measure it by X. But today what happens is all my streams of money have their own individual policy agenda. It's very Salem-centric, and it's not, it doesn't all add up to anything that you could say, aha, that's the state policy on housing or safety net services. So I think that's the opportunity. And I think the other piece I want to just call attention to here on this slide before I move to, so what can you expect in the fall, is that part of the call to action, truthfully, is that we have a fiscal challenge right in front of us. And so, you know, there's a money reason to move fairly quickly. And I've talked to this body about that a little bit in the past. And so one of the good conversations I'm having with my stakeholders is they feel what they want to say is, well, housing ought to be subsidized. It shouldn't have to be. Every individual program shouldn't have to be self-sufficient. And so they're challenging me on this notion of I have to put forward programs that are financially sustainable, right? And I think that's true. I think what's different is let's subsidize them intentionally. Today, I'm internally subsidizing programs in a pretty ad hoc way that isn't informed by that North Star, that sort of bigger picture policy. And if we want to go here, we only have this much money here, but it's so important and the outcomes are so good, let's subsidize and let's do more of that. I think that's a really good conversation to have, but let's do it in the open and with transparency and with intention. And so I think there's all these drivers really come together, diffuse policy, a fiscal challenge, local control, 8 bodies, operating in silos, all those things, in my mind, it feels very chaotic, but there's hope. And I really feel like this is the moment when we can sort of take all of that chaos and say, let's make the system better. We're doing a lot of transformation all over state government, mm-hmm. and I was pleased to just hear the update right before mine, and I think it fits right in there. We've got to do things better. We don't have enough money to keep doing it the way we've been doing it.
And Representative Whitnett, I think you and I have gone through the turmoil of going from the commissions to the Children and Family Commission to the Early Learning Council. Yeah, and I think it's similar to this. Yeah, so it's hard. Any other questions or comments? You look puzzled. Did I not make the right analogy? Okay, thank you. All right.
So should I go ahead and continue?
Sure.
Yes. So quickly, I know you've got a big agenda. So you've seen this timeline before, and we are in the middle of September. And so what that means is we have wrapped up the phase that has program data collection. We've been scanning best practices from around the country and sort of how do other states organize this work. We had a robust survey process with our employees and those stakeholders to elicit their good ideas about how could we make the system better. All of that is culminating in the formation of teams whose job it is over the next 6 weeks to build options or scenarios. And so I've got subject matter experts around the table, around 6 different tables, who are going deep and saying, given all of this data, what options can we put forward for the housing director, the governor, and the legislature to consider starting in the winter? And so the next 6 weeks, we've got folks in a very structured process taking all the data and developing alternative pathways. And I want to show you another graphic because I think it helps. I'm going to skip ahead to this graphic. So today, this is what service delivery looks like, right? And it's another depiction of the state of Oregon is in the middle. We get streams of money, and we send it out the door, and then the people that we send it to ultimately help the low-income people. So what these scenario teams are doing is thinking about, are there alternate ways for the state of Oregon's role to be constructed so that we serve people better? Sometimes, in some cases, they may say, state government could get out of the way altogether. That dollar doesn't have to make a stop in state government. It could just go directly to the local nonprofit. And I think we have to be open to that possibility. In other cases, they say, that dollar looks a lot like a dollar that's administered at the health authority or at the Department of Energy or at DHS. So let's merge those and get a bigger bang for the buck before it goes out to the local nonprofit. There's all kinds of scenarios or options that are possible, and these teams over the next 6 weeks are going to take all the data in a really structured way, come out with some recommendations in early November about sort of how could it look different to serve people better and to drive us towards the desired future state. It's an art, not a science. There's no math equation that you can look at to say, aha, $15 if I do this as compared with how I'm doing it now. But I'm really convinced that if we take a serious look at the way funds flow program by program and think differently about what's that dollar supposed to do and what's the best way to make sure it really does its job, whether that's housing a homeless person or paying the energy bill for a low-income homeowner, whatever it is, let's drive it towards the outcome that we want, regardless of what the implications are for state government's role. So in November, I'll have sets of recommendations for my 49 programs, and I will share them publicly, and I will come back here when you have legislative days in November, and I'll have lots and lots of conversations with all the stakeholders about what do I think it means and what's my best thinking about how to bring it into a single set of recommendations in February.
Representative Gallegos, I think you're involved with this group you and Representative Wisnet.
Right.
I think the thing is,
we clearly want you to succeed and succeed with this effort. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you had mentioned that the whole purpose being more people, I don't know how you stated it, more people having stable housing. To me, that's a North Star. That's a goal.
Sure.
And I think that I'm really very much in favor of community-based planning and really involving, you know, the consumers and people at the level of service delivery in helping to determine policy and direction. But I think that those groups also need some sort of guidance as well to come up with those kinds of recommendations. So I do appreciate your coming and your sharing sort of the process. And that's what I was asking for earlier. Is I know you also hired a consultant to help with this. And again, really wanted to know how it is we're going to end up this spring with a plan. I mean, that's sort of, at least from my perspective, our goal here. And again, we want you to succeed, and I think we want to know how we can best help you to do that.
So Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos, I would say your deepest engagement is likely to be in, you know, November, as you see the first preview of what's coming out of the scenario work, and then again in February. What I would say is that the plan will be pretty high level. It's not that we'll have a new plan for a new organizational structure or a new service delivery map, and that on March 1st we'll put it in place and go on about our merry way. It's going to take time to implement. And so my expectation is that the recommendations will be pretty high level, Maybe some will be more fleshed out than others. I might be able to say more, you know, more firmly, okay, with the suite of programs that provides food security, for example, there seems to be broad consensus that we could do this, and we could probably get that done in a year. Other places we may say there is a bigger lift. We need more analysis. There's not consensus. We need more study. So let's hold off before we do more on multifamily housing, for example. So I think to some degree, just knowing that the recommendations are going to be pretty high-level plan. And then I think because of your work in communities and as part of this body, you will have a perspective that can inform in sort of November and then leading up to February that I think will be this added element. So far, all I've been able to do is bring you process updates. There will be something really tangible to chew on beginning in November, and I think that that will be the most important engagement of this body, if that makes sense.
Any other questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
I have one simple question and then one kind of broad comment. Okay. What is ELT on your timeline?
Sorry. Enterprise Leadership Team. That is the body convened by Mike Jordan, Chief Operating Officer. It's the 24 agency heads who are working together with Mike Jordan to sort of help do the management side of state government that complements the policy development side.
Okay, well, that's very helpful. That kind of leads to my comment, I guess, because yes. It's so big, it's hard to know where to yes. jump in to say
yes.
anything. But at
yes.
one level, I was hoping that you're having that discussion about how do we bring these processes together, because mm-hmm. in the health arena, which we were hearing about yesterday, they're talking about trying to align eligibility for Medicaid with food stamps.
Yes.
So
yeah.
if you're on food stamps, you don't have to have these continual applications. And so I'm hoping that you're not going to have all that worked out in the next year, but I'm hoping that you've got the processes whereby you can find that alignment for eligibility. So that's kind of the statewide coordination level. And then from the other end, the community level, I just remember at Portland Children's Levy, we would have a lot of discussions about, because our partners are all the community groups delivering the services, which is the same for you and to a large degree DHS, how do we really, you know, what is the role of government in supporting the stability of those community organizations? And so that got translated into, you know, what's an acceptable administrative overhead. So in times of right. leanness, we try to squeeze that out, and yet that undermines their ability to be very stable and have a strong, you know, have good information systems and hiring practices. And I'm sure that's a tension, but I'm hoping that somewhere, again, because DHS has a lot of community partners, there's some thought about how do we be good partners in supporting a strong nonprofit sector to deliver these services. Yeah. So it's not really a question. It's a, you know, when you come back to us, if that's an area you could address, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, Chair Potomay and Representative Kenny Geyer, absolutely. And it's something that the partners talk to me and my team about with great regularity. And one of the sort of the tenets of this has been when they first started hearing me talk about there's fiscal reasons I have to do this. And so I think they were quick to caution me not to save money in Salem by pushing burdens onto the local actors. And that's mm-hmm. a little bit of the theme that you're surfacing there, and so that's been very present mm-hmm. And it's part of the instructions, if you will, to these scenario build teams. This isn't about just saving a buck here and shifting mm-hmm. the burden mm-hmm. to somebody else, but what's that helpful role that state government can play that complements and supports what's happening locally? It's an art, not a science.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing from you. I assume you're through.
I'm through.
Okay.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you in November.
Thank you, Margaret.
And next we have Patricia Baxter and Patrice Botsford from the Department of Human Services, and I want to welcome Representative Gelser, who had been in a revenue committee, right?
Yes. No reporting available here, apparently.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And if you have your packets, but if not, you've got them, I guess, on your computer.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Baxter. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Developmental Disabilities Program and the Aging and People with Disabilities Program at the Department of Human Services. And with me today is Patrice Botsford, the Director of the Office of Developmental Disability Services at the Department. We're here today to give you an update and an overview of the Developmental Disabilities Program and some things that are currently going on with that program that we're excited about, that we think will help us to better serve the populations that that program is designed to help. We've got a high-level PowerPoint presentation for you here, starting on the first page, just a reminder of the mission of the Office of Developmental Disability Services. We're really there to support individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities to live safe and healthy lives, and really in a way that they choose to live, with all the same rights and responsibilities that any Oregonian has. We want them to live a life that each and every one of us is allowed to live in the community, engaged in the community, living real lives. We have three key goals, and Patrice will touch on some other goals a little later in the presentation. But from a program-wide perspective, we're really about supporting individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities to have, as I said, that same life as all Oregonians are entitled to. This includes providing supports to families and supports to our provider organizations that work with these individuals day in and day out. Who do we serve? We have about 21,000 individuals that are enrolled in our program, and they're served through a variety of different ways. Some receive case management services only, and this is a service that helps them to get connected to the resources that are available to them. It's not necessarily providing direct service, but helping them organize services around them to support them. All eligible children and adults receive case management services, so the entire 21,000 that are enrolled are entitled to case management services. We have about 7,500 adults that are receiving in-home support services. So these are services that are provided in their own home, in their family home, to help them live as independently and safely as possible, supporting them in their daily activities. And we have between 1,500 and 1,700 children at any time who are receiving family support services. And these are not necessarily services that are provided by the department or through our service delivery partners through in the counties and our support service brokerages. In many cases, this is simply referring families to other resources that are available to them. We have a very strong family-to-family network that put on a lot of programs in local communities. So that's what the family support services include. And then we have about 7,000 children and adults that are receiving what we call comprehensive services. Comprehensive services are those 24-hour services that are outside of the family home, so group homes, foster home settings. And I'm going to turn this over to Patrice now, who will get into some of the specifics about what we're currently doing with the program to improve upon access to services.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, representatives. The Community First Choice, or the K-Plan, is what people are most interested in. We are brand new in our paths working on this new plan. It's the new Medicaid state plan for DD and for APD. It leverages additional Medicaid
funds. Patrice, could you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Patrice Botsford, Director of Developmental Disabilities at DHS.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the reminder. So anyway, it leverages additional Medicaid funds that really allow us to reinvest back in our community. It's allowed us to increase the pay and to have benefits for personal support workers for the first time in our system. It aligns the service to disability-related needs, so as the plans are developed and people know what they want to do as their goals are set for them, to really help them build those skills so that they can reach those goals as independently as possible and really give people the dignity of independence. It applies both to in-home services, so in the family home where they can be supported by a family member as a paid caregiver, or in the home of their choice, where they can be supported by a personal support worker. It also applies to comprehensive services, and those are the services that people are generally most familiar with in foster care or in 24-hour group homes in those settings. The benefits of the Community First Choice Plan, it broadens the population that's served, and for the first time, it opens the door for children who are Medicaid eligible to get services early in their lives, to give the kinds of supports that families need. And many of us are very aware that if we would have been able to offer some of those, we would have been able to keep more families intact and give those parents the support and the respite that they needed. It provides services in the family home. And best of all, it eliminates the need for a crisis to arise in order to receive services. Prior to this new state plan, a family would actually have to declare a crisis and at times have been asked to either say or put in writing that they would require their child to leave the home. Then we would open the door to a statewide search for placement in order for them to get ongoing funding. And that no longer will be true, and we will no longer have to be a crisis-driven system in order to meet the needs of these individuals that we serve.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for coming today. I think this is one of the most exciting pieces of the K-Plan. But one of the things that I'm still hearing from folks in the field is that even though this capacity is there, there isn't an infrastructure to assess the kids for eligibility. That I've heard there are only two people in the entire state that can assess these hundreds and possibly over 1,000 kids that are waiting. How quickly can those kids have access? Because until they're Medicaid eligible, we don't fix this crisis problem.
Right. We are working very rapidly. We are going to be using the SNAP tool for children so that we are able to assess them quickly. And we are circling the wagons as quickly as possible to get our staff trained and to get community staff trained to do those assessments. We'd like to be able to pull that trigger October 1. And in some areas, we may actually be successful at that, but it's going to take us a little more time. We're headed towards that January 1 full implementation goal for our assessment process.
And so will there be more than that current two people?
Oh, yes. Yes, we're training our field so that they will be able to do that. So the new state plan helps us meet a variety of key goals. Keeping people in their homes where they most want to be and where their families want them to be and where they, in the long run, are the most successful. Continuing to support families in their home communities. So going back to not having that requirement to do a statewide search for a vacancy so we can get you in someplace so we can bring funding into your service system. Improvement in employment outcomes. As we reviewed employment over the last few weeks and, you know, sharing responsibility with Employment First, we realized that there really are some things that happen in a person's daily employment life that could be built to the K-Plan, and we can leverage some of those ADL activities to assure that those employment dollars go farther on the employment side and we leverage the money that would support the ADLs. And the goal of improving quality assurance to ensure that people are healthy and safe. So what will success look like? People with intellectual and developmental disabilities will continue to live in their family home where they want to live. They will be able to choose who provides their service. They will choose when and where that service is provided. And they will be safe excuse me, and healthy in their home community. The challenges. Oh, my. We've had a few. Guardianship has been one of those key challenges. Guardians as paid care providers has been something that we've had to work very hard on, and we've had a lot of trouble getting the information to the field. It seems that positive information doesn't have the magnetic attraction that negative information has. So we worked with our CMS partners who originally said that...
Tell us why that's become a problem. In the past, family members would have guardianship, and they would also be paid caregivers.
They would be
right?
paid caregivers.
So tell us why that changed.
Well, CMS saw it as a conflict of interest.
Okay.
So if I am the guardian of my child and I'm sitting at the table and actually running the service plan, and then I determine the hours of service, I determine the rate of pay, and I hire me. And then I determine the hours I'm going to work in the home, I sign my own time card, and I assure my service was given. And there are no other checks and balances in that service side of the system. So CMS saw that as
CMS
a serious...
CMS is a federal agency.
Yes, it's the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. And they saw that as a conflict of interest and as an issue. So we worked with them on 42 CFR 441.505. And it said clearly that guardians could not be paid as there was a conflict of interest. And when we thought, yeah, there might be some wiggle room there, when we checked and did the follow-up with our CMS Region 10 partners and with some national experts that are consultants with CMS, they agreed that guardians could not be paid. So we made the request to actually seek an exception process. And as we did that, CMS decided that they would be willing to relook at how that was worded, because that was not actually their intention. They wanted to be able to address the conflict of interest, but they weren't saying they felt the guardians could not be paid, and we were all very excited about that option. So they said guardians could be paid if there was a process in place. So we've been working with them over the last 2.5 weeks to develop what that process looks like. I think we're down to the final wording, and it looks pretty elegant in its simplicity. The guardian will name someone to sit in their stead for K-Plan services only, and that person then will monitor the service and sign the time card for that individual. Thus, the conflict of interest that they were so concerned about is alleviated, and those individuals can be paid care providers for their
adult. This is one of the reasons we asked for this presentation today, because we are hearing from our constituents who have a great deal of concern about what would happen with their dependent family member, and that they would have to send them outside of their home. So I'm glad we're hearing this today. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, could you explain maybe a little bit further, when you say paid guardians, do they also get the same kind of benefits that a personal worker would get? In other words, what kind of benefits? Do they get worker protection kinds of rights, that kind of thing?
That is my understanding, but I will go back and verify that and get that information for you to double-check and make certain.
Yeah.
They would still be a personal support worker.
Thank you.
Good question. Representative Gelser.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I know that this has been really difficult and has been terrifying for a lot of families when they got a letter from their provider or from DHS saying that they needed to contact an attorney and decide whether to give up caregiving or their guardianship by December 1st. I think one of the things that was very positive was all of the stakeholders coming together, and I know SEIU and Disability Rights Oregon and Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities were pretty quick to point out that in that CFR, it talked about, kind of built into the regulations, the ability to delegate for the purpose of that planning a different person. So I just want to be clear that the Affordable Care Act never actually said that guardians couldn't be paid caregivers. It just said that states need to clarify what their conflict of interest policy is. And I know that's been a concern for people because they're worried that there has to be a change in federal law or federal regulation, which takes a long time.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. So we are very pleased. Challenging and taxing as it has been for all of us, we immediately sent out a notice to the field, followed that with a second notice to the field, and then followed that with an AR to our...
please, use words.
An action request.
Thank you.
To our county case management entities and to the brokerage entities, asking them to actively engage those individuals they know have a paid guardian to assure them that they can continue to be paid. So even with 3 follow-ups, it's not been, again, hasn't had the magnetic force that the first one did. So that's been one of our many challenges. The needs assessment that serves everyone, we are working towards that goal of the January 15 budget note to have one assessment that will work for our entire population. So we are currently madly working in the background on the product that we will be using for the adult side of services, and we'll be using the SNAP for children until next fall, when the children's piece of that will be nationally normed, and we'll be online, so we will be in line for our January 15 deadline for assessments for everyone. Timing of technology to meet the federal requirements. Again, we are just playing catch-up with our systems and trying to get them in place as rapidly as we possibly can. We all know that we have many partners at OHA and DHS, and they are all experiencing rapid change and significant advancement in their system, and so we're all looking to enhance and to support systems that need those kinds of changes. And then finally, the CMS expectations. ODDS underwent two major CMS audits in 2011. We have those reports, and that also is going to require some system changes in order to meet the requirements that CMS has for us.
Yes,
Representative Gelcher. Yes. Thank you. So on the assessment, over the last week, I've gotten questions about, I guess a lot of people went and trained on a new functional needs assessment and spent some time doing that, but they've gotten a communication that that won't be used, and you'll be going back to the SIS that they used to use. Can you clear, and that's the comprehensive inventory of support. Can you kind of clarify what's happening with the inventories and what people can expect for eligibility?
The rest of us explain what all of that means.
Okay. So we currently have a support intensity scale that we call the SIS. That
support
intensity scale.
Okay.
That is used to determine the rates for and the service needs, assess service needs for individuals in comprehensive services. So that tool was developed by the a National Association for Developmental Disabilities, and it is very involved, and it takes a great deal of training. And when we investigated that originally, it looked like that would be completely out of our ability to pay for that service. And so we went about trying to structure a functional needs assessment tool of our own. We have staff that are incredibly talented, did a major amount of work, did incredible training, only to come down to the wire and realize we simply don't have the national norming that we need for a true algorithm to determine what those budget rates would be in relationship to the assessed needs for those individuals. About that time, we heard from that national association that developed the support intensity scale that they do, in fact, have a support intensity scale light that they will work with us to do for our entire population that takes less intense training. It doesn't take 4 or 5 hours. It takes about an hour and a half once people are trained. And it's nationally normed for adults. And then the association that we work with that develops the algorithms said, yes, if we have a nationally normed product, we can actually develop those algorithms. So we are working with them to do that. They are also developing the children's side, had already been working on that. It will have been through its norming process nationally by next fall. So we will have that to connect to the adult side as well and have one support intensity scale that we can use for our entire population. So it's a lot of training, and we have to back up a bit. We own that. We worked furiously with the very best minds that we have, and we simply weren't able to get to the place that we needed to be for that national norming. We wanted to have the credibility that our consumers are due.
Any further questions? Move on. Thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Ensuring long-term success. In order to do that, we really have to have increased quality assurance, and this will really let us know if we are achieving the outcomes that we desire, that people are healthy, that they are safe, that they're receiving quality Medicaid-funded services. We will do that quality assurance across our own internal processes to assure that we're audit-worthy, to work with our service providers to assure that, again, that they are providing that quality Medicaid-funded service, and across all case management entities to assure that people are getting the services that they are entitled to.
So is this new, or is this something that's been ongoing?
We have had quality assurance in developmental disabilities in sort of fits and starts over time, and it was actually a part of the supports that you provided for us. And so we have 10 positions that we will be developing that team with so that we can actually do that quality assurance. We are in the process right now of hiring that quality manager as we develop that team. So we will now have a fully functioning team.
I guess what I'm wondering is if this has come about because of the K plan.
No.
Okay.
This has come about because we have a need to make certain that we are doing that quality assurance at the statistically valid level and with the level of frequency that we need to be audit-worthy as a Medicaid-funded program.
And who would do this audit?
Pardon?
Who would do such an audit?
The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services.
Okay, you're wanting to make sure you meet
right.
the level that CMS.
Right. And then to really have a way for our community to give us the kinds of feedback that we need on a regular basis so that
community
we know.
Community meaning?
Meaning the people that we serve and their families, so that we're really surveying them and getting the information from them, that we hear from our service providers rather than, you know, on the intermittent level that they are licensed, that we hear from them regularly on how we are doing, not just how they are doing, and that we're able to adjust our system as we see changes need to take place.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative,
I have a question. Really appreciate your presentation. I've just always been of the belief that this area of work has traditionally been underpaid and understaffed, and it's sort of like the backwater of our service programs. But I think that it seems to me that the work you're doing and sort of what's reflected in this is that we've come a long way from those days. And gratefully so. But I'm curious. I just want to ask you: Are workers, providers in this field, adequately paid? Because it used to be that they were just abysmally paid, underpaid.
You know, I think they have organized well, and I think that there are portions of the field that are improving. In that pay scale and benefits.
Yeah.
We're still concerned about that traditional provider community where they are less organized, and we fear they're going to lose some of their workers.
Well, if we talk about quality, I mean, the quality of the provider, I think, mm-hmm. and the benefits and the...
Yes, and we will be back soon to have that discussion with you.
Great.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the issue of kids. You had said that SNAP, that the assessment tool you're going to use will be ready by October 1st.
Mm-hmm.
How many children per month do you expect to be able to enroll over the course of that first 6 months of that several hundred that are waiting?
Well, I don't know. And I will go back and find those numbers for you. I'm sorry, I just spilled the water she so generously gave me all over the...
Do you need anything more?
So sorry.
I'm not sure that's the first time that has ever happened.
Thank you. So anyway, I will go back and find out what the numbers are. It's an excellent question, and it's a number I really hadn't looked to research. So we'll
and if you would get that to Christy, then she would send it out to all of us.
All right.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any questions? Other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time today.
It was very interesting to hear all of this, and I think it gives us some more information that we can impart to our constituents who call us about these issues that are very concerning to these folks.
Yes,
they are. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for coming. Now we have the Department of Corrections, an overview of the transition programs in public safety. And I think not everybody we have on our list is here.
They're taking good notes on this presentation. It's a few more members.
Do you know anything about any of these folks that are missing?
I don't. I'll go in the hallway and look.
We
have already. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Good. Hi there. Thank you for coming. We had Steve Burr and Tom Johnson also scheduled. They're from the police, Salem Police Department, so maybe there was an emergency they were called to. So that would be great. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Tomei. For the record, my name is Cindy Booth. I'm the Administrator for Transition and Reentry for the Oregon Department of Corrections. Thank you for inviting us to present today. This morning, I'm again going to spend a bit of time giving you a broad overview of the Oregon Department of Corrections so we have a common understanding of how our agency operates. From there, I'm going to talk about what the work of the department is and the transition services we provide to help aid inmates with successful transition back to the community. Make sure I can operate this effectively. I'm not licensed for this, you know. I'd like to start with a brief overview of the Department of Corrections. The mission of the department is to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of future criminal behavior. The first part of our mission is something that we have refined over the years, yet holding offenders accountable is more than simply carrying out the court's orders and removing offenders from society for a prescribed period of time. It's important to note that we send inmates to prison as punishment, not for punishment. Holding them accountable means helping them to be successful, acknowledge and take responsibility for their behaviors and actions, and to make commitments for positive change. I'm going to talk more about this in just a moment. The second half of our mission is to reduce the likelihood that individuals will commit another crime after release. And what this means for the department is that another victim is not created when the offender returns to the community. I'd like to discuss the different stages we use and strategies we use to achieve our mission throughout this presentation. This slide provides some additional statistics about our department. You'll notice that we are the largest general fund state agency behind that of the Department of Human Services. We have approximately 14,500 adults in custody across the state. We have 14 institutions, and the Department of Corrections is responsible for Douglas and Lynn counties, who provide direct supervision, and we also collaborate with the other 34 counties around the state.
Could you tell us what that means, two field offices in these two counties?
Forgive me, the year I believe was around 2004 or 5. The funding for community corrections fell below baseline, and those two counties were able to opt out of providing community correction services at the county level, and they returned that responsibility to the state. So
the state has a county jail in those two counties?
Chair Tomei, in those two counties, we operate the community corrections services for those counties. So they report to the Community Corrections Division under the Department of Corrections. In the other 34 counties, these services, community correction services, are provided by community corrections agencies that are either under the sheriff's office or report to the county commissioners.
So when we hear about counties that may declare bankruptcy, then are we to assume that then county or state corrections would also assume the responsibility for the corrections department in those counties?
Chair Tomei, that is a possibility. If funding were to fall below, we would look to provide services as best as possible to support them in their efforts. The legislative funding is what drives the opt-out option for community corrections. So if a county declares bankruptcy, I understand that there are other contingencies in law passed during the 2013 session that would allow the governor and legislators to look at helping the counties provide their mandated services.
So that's in the future. This happened, as you said, maybe in 2004. I should remember this, but I don't. So we're saying that because they didn't have the funding that they would have gotten, say, through property taxes, Douglas and Lynn counties didn't have that funding, and so the responsibility fell onto state corrections, correct?
Chair Tomei, that is correct in part. It had to do with the legislative level of funding to community corrections at that point in time. and it opened the window for what's called opt-out. And we can provide you with correct dates and detailed information about the county decisions to return those community correction services to the state.
Okay, that would be great.
That would be
Thank
helpful.
You.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think if I'm correct, the county's opted out because we weren't providing, the state wasn't providing them the money to run those programs. It's supposed to be 80-some bucks a day or something. And for the counties to run all their programs.
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnant, that is correct in terms of the legislative level of funding available at that time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Continuing on with this slide, the Department of Corrections has grown approximately 97% since 1995, and we admit approximately 5,000 every year to prison and release approximately 4,500 per year. This 14,500 currently in custody across the state does not, however, include the nearly 350 Department of Corrections youth who are housed at the Oregon Youth Authority. These are youth who are sentenced as adults under mandatory minimum or waiver statutes, and we house them as provided by state law with the Oregon Youth Authority. I'd like to share these statistics because I think it's important for people to understand what we do and why we do it. Incarceration is expensive. We spend $84.81 a day to incarcerate adults in Oregon prisons. 93% of these inmates return to Oregon communities. When an individual commits a new crime, Oregon spends another approximately $100,000 just sending him or her back to prison. Building new prisons is expensive, $200 to $400 million, which does not include ongoing operational costs. If we can reduce recidivism rates by 1%, we can save approximately $4.3 million in annual victim and taxpayer costs. I'd like to talk about how we do that. I'm going to briefly talk about what works in corrections. We know from research and experience that the most effective way to reduce future criminal behavior is to provide adults in custody with the right combination of treatment, job preparation, and education. In addition, research generally tells us that punishment without correctional treatment does not reduce recidivism. Putting offenders with a low risk to recidivate into programs does not reduce recidivism. And effective programs must address known criminal risk factors. I'm going to talk briefly about each of these areas, starting with treatment.
Cindy, I'm going to stop you just
yes.
a minute. I had worked with a woman long ago who talked about corrections, that that's in the title, Department of Corrections, and yet I think one of the first things you gave us, a mission, is to promote public safety by putting people, I guess, in jail or prison and reducing the risk of future criminal behavior. But there's nothing about correcting behavior or correcting erroneous thinking. And I'm wondering why that is.
Chair Tomei, your question is with regard to the mission itself?
Yeah.
In the part of the mission regarding holding offenders accountable, it is through our treatment, education, and job programs that we work to both hold them accountable and help them correct criminal thinking, cognitive behavioral issues, provide them with treatment and work skills opportunities to change their lives.
And how many people, what percentage of people in the prison system actually take advantage of these services?
I will cover a little bit of that, Chair Tomei, if I might, through the presentation. And then if that doesn't answer your question, we would be happy to provide you with more distinct numbers or percentages.
Great.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
I was trying to write down. I didn't do it fast enough. The sentence that you said right before that, which had to do with low-risk offenders, something.
Yes. Placing low-risk to reoffend offenders in programs is proven to not be effective.
To not be effective.
Yes. And I can, I think,
you're going to go on and talk about that. Okay, thank
Excuse
you.
Excuse me, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative.
I think, Cindy, the mission statement is pretty accurate for what you've come up with over the years and everything, but it's pretty encompassing.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it catches the treatment piece of it that we've always tried to kind of work with. It catches the educational piece of it to try to advance and to prepare people to come out. It captures also the connection with the community corrections for the transition part of it. I mean, and this was part of what we really kind of looked and explored over the last couple of years and everything, more so with the public safety package. But this really captures, I mean, in essence, what we're,
you know, words are important to me. And
yeah,
so
yeah, I get you.
It's not anything about correcting behavior. Mm. It's punishing by locking them up and somehow reducing the risk. But that could that be torture? I mean, I'm just going to extremes here.
Yes.
But I mean, that's all in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? So what does that mean to reduce the risk? And I'm hearing from you that there are programs, et cetera. But I guess it's somewhat disappointing that in the mission statement that it's not more specific about correcting behavior. So, can we,
Absolutely.
The statement that Representative Kenny Geyer asked about, can you repeat that? I'm still having trouble understanding that.
Chair Tamayo. The comment was, putting offenders with a low risk to recidivate into programs does not reduce recidivism. And later we talk about the risk to reoffend, determining a person's risk to reoffend and what correctional interventions can be put in place to assist them to lower their risk. If a person is already low risk to reoffend, providing them with certain programs actually can make them worse, for lack of a better term.
Really?
The types of interventions, the degree and dosage of intervention is, and the timing of such are critical to a person's incarceration phase, not only for the point while they're incarcerated, but also in preparing them for release to the community. Often those who are low risk to reoffend do not need to be spending time in programs around persons who are higher risk to reoffend, where they may be observing or learning behaviors that are detrimental to their success in the community.
Kenny Geyer?
Thank you. So that's, you see, it's the first thing that you had said seemed counterintuitive to me, that you know, you'd think you'd have the highest rate of success by providing support and programs to those least likely to reoffend. So I'm wondering if it's because of the design of the program, putting them in with higher risk people, and if you had something geared for their level of risk, whether there could be more success about that. So I don't know if there's national studies or if you've differentiated to that degree, or if you're going to answer that in the rest of this presentation, but this is the first I'm hearing about it, and so I'm trying to grasp that concept.
Representative Tomei, Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, I believe that we'll talk about that in this presentation, but also your point is well made with regard to services to low-risk individuals. The challenge of the department in arena of limited resources is to be able to provide a level of service to those who are low risk to reoffend that assists them in group or individual settings with other low risk individuals. There are cognitive behavioral programs that are geared toward low risk individuals. It isn't necessarily a program array that we would contract for. It would be something we would look to do within department resources, for example, counselor-led groups, things like that. Also participation in some of the reentry programs that are available in the department and gearing them toward groups of individuals who are low risk to reoffend and have like needs around those types of services. So,
So just to follow up, thank you. We had heard during the session of some of those reentry programs, and I visited one of them at Coffee Creek, and they had such a high rate of success. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm trying to put those different pieces of information we've had together with what you're saying.
Thank you. Yes. And at some point, could you talk some about general assistance and how that fits in with people who are re-entering the community?
Chair Tomei, I would be happy to. If you'd like, I can speak briefly to it now. General assistance program is something that the Department of Corrections has been interested in working with the Department of Human Services and other agencies over the last few years. It is a service that, if available, would help bridge the gap often experienced by individuals releasing from prison to the community who have yet to receive, for example, their Social Security disability coverage, benefit coverage. Many folks release, even though the Department of Corrections attempts to pre-qualify them to be eligible for Social Security benefits day of release, we are often unable to secure that benefit for them to be available day of release. They cannot receive that service while they're incarcerated. So if their benefit application is rejected, for example, and they must reapply or challenge that denial, then a period of months often goes by while they're on supervision in the community before Social Security reevaluates the application and determines whether or not to provide that benefit service. So the cash assistance that would be available to the individual through the general assistance program would allow them to help pay for their housing, supervision fees, treatment supports, things like that in the community that individuals are responsible for while they're on supervision.
And currently we're not providing that, right?
That is correct. That. The general assistance program ended many biennia ago.
Right, yes. Right. Okay, thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. Thank you. So to continue to access to treatment services, in today's correctional world, we offer treatment and programming to inmates who have a high risk to reoffend, coupled with a high need. With limited resources, we focus on those inmates that are most at risk to reoffend. So it's no longer about institutional behavior, but about risk. In fact, we know from research that putting offenders with a low risk to recidivate into programs can have a negative impact. So we have the responsibility to assess and intervene with the high-risk offender to avoid victimization, recidivism, and costs. Unfortunately, there's always a gap between the resources we do have and the number of inmates who need treatment, including alcohol and drug, cognitive programs, education, parenting, etc. 73% of our offender population has some substance abuse issue, yet we only have 496 treatment beds, 102 for females and 394 for males. These beds can serve inmates with a cognitive need, a substance abuse treatment need, or both. All of our treatment programs incorporate evidence-based practices for cognitive behavioral models of intervention and focus on drug-free, community living, and pro-social thinking. We also include relapse prevention in our treatment programs, and they're voluntary, which requires approximately 6 to 9 months commitment to complete the treatment program, as well as engaging in structured activities for a minimum of 14 hours per day.
Wow. What do you do in those 14 hours?
Chair Tomei, the alcohol and drug and cognitive treatment programs are a therapeutic living environment, a milieu, and they have classes that they participate in, they have homework assignments, and they incorporate work and skill building into their 14-hour structured day. The majority of the high-intensity programs, the living unit itself is, they live together, they eat together, program together, and their recreational time is structured, and they all work together in that.
And they're separate from the rest of the...
They typically, yes, Chair Tomei, they are on living units that are specific to that treatment milieu.
And what proportion of people who could benefit by that and would be willing to do that, are we able to give them those services?
Chair Tomei, I would need to get back to you with regard to the number that we are not able to serve due to the limited number of beds available.
Right.
Have you visited that program?
Where is that program?
We have an alcohol and drug treatment program at Powder River for men. There at Coffee Creek, we have alcohol and drug and cognitive program for women. That is our only female facility. And we have a cognitive treatment program with an A&D component, so it can serve those who have a substance abuse treatment need, for men at Columbia River and at Deer Ridge.
River, and where's Deer Ridge?
Madras, Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
And Chair Tomei, we would be happy to get you details about the number of beds available at each location and the service array.
That would be great. I've been invited to go to Columbia River facility. That's in Multnomah County, right?
Correct.
And I'm hoping to do that maybe before session. Representative, what is your name again? Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate what you're doing for drug and alcohol. I appreciate that there's always a gap there of more. It is a bigger problem for the society than what you're dealing with just in our corrections. However, what do you know about what's happening to prisoners who may never have been introduced to drug and alcohol, or at least not in an addictive way, who are being introduced because of their time in our institutions in Oregon? What do you know about how much drug and alcohol is coming in, and how does it get in there? Because I believe, and this is my opinion based on observations and information, I believe we have a huge drug and alcohol, no, I wouldn't say alcohol, drug problem in our institutions. And people are getting introduced and using drugs, and using drugs as an economy of gangs and so forth. What do you know about what's going on the other end when you're trying to treat those that are coming in addicted?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, I would not be the appropriate person to answer that question, as I do not know the details of. I know that our security investigation unit is acutely in tune with what is occurring and the degree to which we have an issue with regard to drugs, alcohol, or any other contraband coming into the institutions. So if I may, I would be happy to get that information to you.
I'm sure to follow up.
Follow up?
I don't need to belabor this here, but I agree with your point. I would even take it further as far as the mission statement. The correction piece is weak at best, and I believe that the number one goal should be public safety. But I'm with you. I need to know more about correction, and particularly in this issue of drug use and using it as a currency within prison. I suspect, and again, I am talking as is my opinion, I suspect it's horrific what's going on of drugs inside our prisons, and we should probably investigate that.
Why don't we have a hearing on that in November, right, is our next one? And could you, Cindy, can you arrange that, and we'll have a hearing on just that? Representative Gelser, do you want to work with Cindy on making sure that we get exactly the kind of information that you're after?
To the extent that I can, I would be happy to do that. But I'm interested in learning about what I suspect is happening.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Gilliam.
Yeah, I thought that it's yours.
to continue, committee, education can play a major factor in an adult's success upon reentry. Research shows that individuals who participate in correctional education programs have a lower rate of rearrest, reconviction, and reincarceration. The higher an individual's education level goes, the greater the fall in the likelihood that the person will reoffend. Our current recidivism rate is 26.5%. We know that with an associate's degree being earned, that number falls to 14%. With a bachelor's degree, the number falls to 6%. And as in the case of a master's degree, with research indicates the number can fall to zero. Adult basic skills development is general fund dollars that we use to help individuals advance degrees. We try to get them on the right path, relying heavily on our community college partners. It's through the strong collaboration that we have that we're able to provide the Adult Basic Skills Development Program, which includes adult basic education, English as a second language, GED, and special education. We also provide vocational training. They help inmates develop specific skills to assist them in obtaining employment following release. And the programs include training and production components that provide a product or service for pay in order to reduce the cost of these programs. Some of the programs we highlight are automotive technology, construction technology, eyeglass recycling, hair design, and welding certification. The department also has apprenticeship programs in the trades that are in partnership with the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries and the Columbia Gorge Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee. An inmate apprentice will complete 2 to 4 years of trade-specific on-the-job training in addition to 144 hours annually of trade-specific instruction. The apprenticeship programs are self-paid by the inmate. Trade programs include manufacturing plant electrician, limited maintenance electrician, sheet metal, and painting. And these are jobs that often inmates walk out the door having secured employment in these trades prior to their release.
Somebody mentioned that when we were at Coffee Creek that we saw evidence of one of these programs, which is very impressive. But my question is, what proportion of inmates take advantage of these various programs?
Chair Tomei, the proportion of the total number of inmates, I don't have that but can get it for you.
Great.
I can share that the number of apprenticeship programs is small in terms of the number of individuals that can participate at one time, but we would be happy to get you that detail.
Chair. Sure.
Yes, Representative
Gallegos. Yeah, I'm curious about, you know, it seems to me that one of the reasons people end up in these prisons is lack of opportunities, lack of skills, awareness of you know, educational opportunities. So in this intervention, I mean, it does make sense that, you know, we would increase their capacity then to be successful in society, and also to me that would also encourage civic engagement and sort of fully engage in community. What kind of barriers though do these folks experience when they do get out, even though they've gone through these educational programs and so on? Are there things that we could do at the state level that would reduce those barriers to their success once they get out?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gallegos, your question is an excellent one. There are a number of barriers that individuals face. Many of them have limited soft skills, and that is what we hear from employers is the most desired attribute is that
soft skills
such as knowing how to be a good employee, showing up to work on time, showing up to work every day that you're to be at work, putting in a full day of work, working effectively as a team, or taking direction from a supervisor or a lead person. The Governor's Reentry Council a couple of years ago did an employer survey to better understand what it is the employer community is looking for in terms of individuals coming out. Many were willing to give opportunity to individuals, even though they have limited or an extensive criminal record, provided that the individual was working to change their life and that they were willing to work with the employer and be accountable through their parole officer supervision to learn. The employers talked most often about their willingness and the ability to teach skills for the job, provided that the individual came with a desire to be a good employee. We also know from that survey that having a criminal record and how they approach that conversation with the employer is important. So one of the things that we do in some of the reentry programs specific to employment is teach individuals how to present themselves as a prospective employee and how to talk about their crime. Not that that drives who they are now, but to recognize that they have that past and that they were wanting to change their lives for the better. Does that help answer?
For now, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. One more note, if I may, about education. In addition to the programs that we talked about, we offer classes as part of the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program, something you might already be aware of. Prison Inside Out brings academic courses from the colleges into prisons where 12 to 15 incarcerated students learn alongside 12 to 15 students from the outside. The focus is a unique classroom approach that provides dialogue and collaboration and gives each student an opportunity to learn subject matter along with larger issues such as justice and inequality. To date, we've had approximately 1,014 participants in the Inside Out program, 507 who were incarcerated, learning alongside 507 who came from the colleges outside.
Second. Do you have any sense on how successful that's been?
Chair Tomei, I understand that we are participating or working with one of perhaps Portland State University to do an evaluation.
Great.
I'd be happy to get your follow-up on that.
Great. Thank you. Representative Gelfin.
Thank you. How do you recruit your non-incarcerated students to participate in the program? Where do they come from and what piques their interest in the program?
Chair Tomei and Representative Gelser, I'm most familiar with Oregon State University. There is a professor at Oregon State University who has collaborated with the Department of Corrections around research issues, and it was a brainchild of hers, and she helped bring the program forward. And we'll provide a level of background and detail along with the evaluation component when we send our response in.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Work programs. In 1994, Oregon voters enacted Ballot Measure 17, which requires inmates to work full-time or engage in programs. The premise is that inmates who are confined in corrections institutions should work as hard as the taxpayers who provide for their upkeep. And that they must be fully engaged in productive activity if they're to be successful upon reentering society. They need practical skills and a viable work ethic. Inmate work programs are about keeping inmates engaged. It's as much about security management within the institutions as it is about preparing them for reentry. Work opportunities within the institutions range from janitorial to food services to library assistants to education tutors. We also provide work crews. So in addition to coordinating inmate work opportunities within the institutions, the department's work crew coordinators work outside with outside entities to generate partnerships and develop contracts for outside inmate work crews. Our longest standing partnership or relationship is with the Oregon Department of Forestry. This is a 50-plus year partnership where inmates, mostly from the South Fork Forest Camp, have been utilized to fight fires, plant trees, and maintain trails, parks, and campgrounds. The Oregon Corrections Enterprises is really the prison industry's component of our agency, providing work ethics and job skills to adults in custody. It plays an important role in helping us achieve our mission because we know that meaningful work opportunities and job preparedness contribute to successful reentry. It's one leg of a four-legged stool for OCE, offender management and rehabilitation, and community corrections all weave together to improve outcomes for offenders, both within the prison and in the community. OCE employs adults in custody in prison jobs with contact centers, wood fabrication, printing, metal fabrication, and industrial laundry.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Are you still providing contact service for ODOT?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, we are for DMV specifically. We have six contact centers, and we provide DMV services out of two of those centers.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
Representative. I think we toured that with Judiciary Committee one time, and I think there was concern about they're not allowed to get Social Security numbers from people that they're working with, right? They're referring them to somewhere else. They're answering questions about how to get information. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, that is correct. There is certain information that the call center is not able to handle. They turn the caller over to their supervisor on site, who is a DMV employee, and if that person is unable to answer it, then the Department of Motor Vehicles or Department of Transportation, if appropriate, will return the call to the individual.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about community service because we believe it's an important component of holding offenders accountable and giving back. In terms of community service and community outreach, we're engaging more activities beyond the typical work crew opportunities. For example, Coffee Creek, our only female prison, sends a small crew of women two times a month to serve meals at a senior center in the community. Powder River Correctional Facility in Baker City has incorporated into their treatment curricula a section that allows inmates the opportunity to give back to the community by providing community services through speaking engagements where they talk about their addiction and recovery. Several of their recent community outreach activities are shown in this slide. An outreach crew at the County Heritage Museum helped clean and get set up for an event that raises money for the museum, and a crew at the Salvation Army sorted and organized material that's dropped off by the community. Male inmates at the Snake River Institution helped with the 2012 Help Them Hope campaign, which provided food, clothing, toys, and other items to families in need during the holidays. The crew helped sort and package those items. We have a number of other things that we're involved in at various facilities around the state, including community service, crew activities around the American Cancer Society Relay for Life, where they help set up and clean up after the event, Boys and Girls Clubs of the Western Treasure Valley grounds maintenance done for them, Wilsonville Rotary Community setting up and breaking down for events that they host, along with a number of other opportunities that we work with.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
I think there was some bad publicity on the jobs, what's it called, your program that did this recently. Does DOC have an internal audit division? Do you have an internal auditor at DOC that's looking? That's one of the programs that could easily be fraud from it or abuse positions.
Which program that you're referring
to? The one that's building the furniture and all that stuff. This is what we're talking about here. Here's my page. The correction enterprise.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Tomei, Representative Wisnett, yes, the Department of Corrections does have an internal audit office, and we also work with the Oregon Secretary of State's Audits Division around those issues.
Didn't they build the furniture when we remodeled the the House of Chambers?
Represent to me, that's correct. Oregon Corrections Enterprises and the inmates that they employ did build the furniture for the Capitol when it was remodeled.
So, Representative Wisnett, so what was your concern?
I think there was a recent problem that someone resigned or something. I was ahead of that. Is that not true? It was in the paper.
Representative Tomei, Representative Wisnett, that is correct.
Using your personal gain and stuff like that.
Oh, somebody, not an inmate, but a staff person. Thank you. Okay.
To make furniture for his cousin.
Something like that.
Visiting is new to the department's list of what works. It's something we've known anecdotally for years, but we've also had a research paper that has confirmed this. A recent Minnesota Department of Corrections study evaluated the relationship between prison visitation and recidivism among their 16,000 plus offenders who were released between 2003 and 2007. It concluded that offenders who were visited in prison were significantly less likely to recidivate than those who did not receive visits. Specifically, any visit reduced the risk of recidivism by 13% for felony reconvictions, 25% for technical violations and revocations. Visits from siblings, family members, clergy, etc., were the most beneficial. More visits than not were more beneficial. And visits closer to the release date and the more people visiting, so the larger their social network, the better. The last 2 points were also confirmed by studies conducted in both Florida and Canada, where visits closer to release and greater number of visits were found to be more effective. So after reading the study, how many adults in our custody receive no visiting became the question for the department to answer. Unfortunately, we found that a staggering 59% get no visits whatsoever. It's something that, given the space, time, and security staff, it comes at little expense to the department. So we're working to get that number down from 59% to zero.
So I would imagine we have some facilities that are in far eastern Oregon, and so that might be very difficult. And I would imagine that many of the crimes are in the Willamette Valley, and that might be very difficult for families to visit that far away. So are there studies on that? Is there anything done about that?
Representative Tomei, you're correct that the majority of the individuals sentenced to a term of incarceration in the Department of Corrections come from the Willamette Valley metro areas. But depending on the length of their incarceration, the majority are sent to the east side, where we have the greater number of prison beds. And they spend a great deal of time there before we try to move them back to the valley for release planning purposes. However, some of the things that we're looking at as part of increasing visitation opportunities and better engaging families is to look at our visitor policies, our policies around, you know, what constitutes a family, and our policy around persons having a criminal background not being allowed to visit.
Mm-hmm.
We have implemented a video visiting program that provides opportunities for families to visit from afar. We're finding great success in that. We've implemented electronic messaging where inmates who purchase an MP3 player can receive text messages from their family. The family must initiate that process, however. We're also expanding visiting opportunities through increased visiting hours and holding special family events, such as family picnics at Two Rivers facility, well-attended, and families and inmates alike who... Clarification, the inmates had to be of a certain level to, you know, of behavior level to mm-hmm. be able to participate. And great success. It was extremely well attended, and they're already planning for another in the spring. So we are working on finding ways that enhance mm-hmm. visitation opportunities for people that cannot travel. and increase the number of visits that inmates have opportunity for with mentors and other partners from the community. Many of these are also community corrections, both the community corrections parole and probation officers, as well as mentor programs that they have in place.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mention the parenting program here. I visited the program in Coffee Creek and how important that parenting program is for those moms leaving the correctional facility.
Representative Tomei, that's correct. Many of the women who are participating in the parenting program have the Department of Human Services case open, and part of their reunification efforts are around successful completion of parenting program and continuing to work with their DHS caseworker throughout their incarceration. So in closing on this, I'd like to add that visiting is as important, we're finding it as important as programming, education, treatment for adults in custody, and it goes far beyond in benefiting the individual. It greatly impacts on the family that the individual returns to. We know that without intervention, without treatment, and without education and other supports, the attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors that lead to criminal behavior continue to pass from parent to child and on to the next generation. If we're going to improve the lives of children and keep them safe and healthy, if we're going to reduce poverty, stop crime, and make communities safer, we must find effective methods of intervening in and breaking the intergenerational cycle of criminal behavior. So this brings me to the transition and reentry piece. Our transition and reentry unit coordinates release planning efforts for all inmates who release from DOC's legal custody, regardless of their physical location. Our philosophy is that transition begins on day one in prison, but concerted efforts on release planning begin approximately 6 months prior to the release date. With an eye to public safety concerns, release counselors collaborate with the inmate, the family, or their support system, county community corrections agencies, the parole board, Department of Corrections, medical and mental health staff, etc., to develop a plan that is designed for the individual to help the inmate reintegrate into their community, meet their basic needs, such as housing and employment, and ensure the continuity of medical and or mental health care post-release, which, of course, will include the Affordable Care Act that's going into place January 1. The release plan is pretty prescribed. It includes supervision requirements, which are set by the board, and includes information provided by both community corrections and the release counselors who are working with the inmate prior to release. It includes housing and employment opportunities or strategies. It includes support services and, of course, those medical and mental health care referrals. The unit also provides skill-based transition programming designed to address common barriers to reentry, primarily through the department's Road to Success transition curriculum. Inmates learn how to seek and obtain employment, housing, and other supports to be successful, and the program is delivered at 9 of our 14 facilities by staff who are called transition coordinators. County community corrections agencies become the supervising authority once the person releases from prison. And these transition and reentry efforts are closely partnered with these agencies to improve the success and safety of incarceration to community transition. It's important because research has shown that the first 180 days of post-prison supervision are the most critical. This is where the handoff from corrections to community is the most important handoff of the phase. We strive for a seamless handoff where we don't lose the momentum we've gained by reducing the barriers that so often stand in the offender's way. One effort to the transition effective transition is the offender reach-ins. And this is when an offender's PO actually visits with the offender prior to their release to talk specifically about the supervision requirements, answer questions about support services and resources available to them in the community, talks about what the expectations are while they're on supervision, the period of supervision for that individual, etc. It's a chance for the individual to have a face and a name as a contact when they're released from prison. And research has shown us that through a reach-in with a parole officer prior to release, an individual is more likely to report for supervision within the 24 hours of release that they're required to report. In one county, they saw an increase in the number of first-time reports for supervision go up to 97% based on their practice of reaching in with individuals prior to release.
Reach-in is when the parole person will be reaching, going into the prison to meet with these. So how often does that happen?
Chair Tomei, we track the number of reach-ins with our community corrections partners' assistance. We track the number of reach-ins that they provide and look at how close to release that reach-in is. And I would be happy to share that detail, but also know that based on either an in-person or telephonic or now video reach-in, the majority of counties are able and are conducting reach-ins with their releasing population no less than 2 months prior to release.
So not all are, but over 50% are. So that would be interesting to
Church
know
May, yes.
Which counties are doing that, which are not. So which was the very successful county who does a good job of reaching?
Church May, both Multnomah and Marion counties
good.
Reported that by having their staff conduct reach-ins prior to release, that their first-time reports went up to 97%.
Good.
I think Clackamas County does quite well, too, with their program.
Good. Thank you.
This slide shows the reentry prisons. Instead of replicating programs and services at all prisons, Department of Corrections has found it more effective and efficient to actually centralize services in certain prisons and assign inmates to those based on individual program needs. Under this model, some prisons focus primarily on basic education, job training, and work, while others focus on treatment and transitional services. Approximately 6 months prior to release, most inmates are transferred to a regional reentry prison located near their home community. Preparation for release is intensified, and this is a time that they participate in alcohol and drug treatment or cognitive treatment programs if it's appropriate for their case plan to do so. We do all of this to ensure a successful and seamless handoff to community corrections. There are several concrete measures that we rely upon to gauge our effectiveness in community corrections. With a goal that no one returns to the criminal justice system, these are examples that we use to hold community corrections accountable and to provide focus and consistency across the 36 counties that we partner with. First and foremost, it's our goal to reduce recidivism. We continue to see a decline in those who commit new felonies within a 3-year period following incarceration. While we'll never be satisfied with even one person committing another crime, we can take pride as a state in continually achieving low recidivism rates and seeing those rates continue to decline. Community corrections, along with the rest of our public safety partners, Oregon's public safety policies, and the support of communities and families receive credit for the great work that is being done in this arena. Some of this work is being done through the monitoring of supervision conditions, but supervision goes well beyond condition monitoring. It involves assessment and evaluation, the creation of an individualized case plan that recognizes the offender as an individual who has risks, needs, and needs resources and services available to help them change. We call this the risk-need responsivity model, and it creates a culture where the offender is part of the change process. It aids in recognizing the areas in his or her life that need work, motivating the individual to create buy-in, and ultimately holding them accountable to the plan that's put in place. From there, we promote evidence-based programs through our programs and employment opportunities, both in the institution and on the outside. We partner with local organizations that help with employment, housing, and treatment, along with veterans assistance. All are critical in addressing the needs of individuals under supervision. In addition, we're able to track and monitor how victims are responded to through restitution payments and community service. But the work with victims goes well beyond these two measurements. For example, domestic violence parole officers network with shelters and crisis lines, collaborating with victim advocates and other law enforcement agencies to ensure that victims are protected and provided with opportunities to succeed in light of the tragedies that they've endured. And I would be happy to answer questions.
You've been answering a lot of questions, Cindy.
Help get information back to you.
Thank you, Cindy. Yes, and we would like to have a follow-up meeting. I think in November we'll make sure that we have time for that.
Thank you.
But I think we asked some questions here that yes. we'd like some follow-up on. Yes,
so thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I would love to see is, you know, if you had 100, I'm taking the figure 100,000 because that's what it costs if one person recidivates and goes back into the prison system, and you did the whatever treatment reentry is needed for the low to reoffend group, maybe you would have 20 people in that group, and maybe normally 16 would not reoffend. Four would, and maybe through that $100,000 intervention, you would manage to have two that would not reoffend. That would save $200,000. That'd be $2 for every. If you had $100,000 and you were going to take a higher risk to offend, maybe you could only that would only serve 10 of them. And out of the 10, maybe five normally would reoffend, five wouldn't, and you were able to save one. So for that same $100,000, you're saving one in one situation, two in another. Maybe the numbers are totally different, but I'm curious, like, what are the numbers? Because I'm still curious about that statement that you said. What is the best practice say around the country? What are we doing with regard to the best practice? I'm just curious about that. Because I want us to make our, you know, we wish we could serve everyone and treat everyone, but if we have to prioritize, where do we get the most bang for the buck?
Good question.
Representative Kinnegar, we'd be happy to provide information on what research is showing around evidence-based practices and what interventions would be effective with low-risk to reoffend inmates as compared to those that are high and moderate risk.
Because you do have the, I think, of the reentry programs that you do
yes.
as being successful, and I consider that an investment. Maybe it's you're thinking of treatment as something different than I am, but it's an investment. And so what do these things cost, and what's the success rate? So compared to that $100,000 per person who recidivates.
Representative Olson, did you have something further?
Cindy, thanks, Madam Chair. You and I have kind of talked about this before over the past year and everything, but I would really appreciate maybe in November if you could just give us just a little snapshot view of the dollars that are earned while in Department of Corrections and upon release, how that's then routed through the Oregon Trail Card. And because we're in a work group right now working on that a little bit, and there's, let's face it, there's some serious, misconception as to what does that trail card involve. Well, I thought it was all nothing but food stamps. I mean, that's what I thought it was, but it's not. It's bigger than that.
So tell the committee what you and I know about that.
Well, it's top secret, isn't it? So far, there's three different, I think there's more than three, but the three main avenues that we have right now for the use of the trail card is your SNAP program, your TANF, and then also the dollars that are earned while you're in incarcerated.
And they can use those dollars for anything they
want.
That's
right. Because they
run those. So sometimes when you see people using a card for something, you think, well, they shouldn't be using it to buy cigarettes. If they earned it in prison, and those are very separate inside the same card. They're separate, what is the
accounts.
Word? Accounts, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was something very interesting that we learned in that work group.
I know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't have to go into great detail, but it would be fun to go over that again.
Yeah, it would be. And what proportion, how many people would have those extra funds? How much might that be? How did they earn it, et cetera? It would be interesting for us to learn that. Representative Gallegos.
I just want to go back to Representative Kenny Geyer's point. I'm aware of Volunteers America's program, particularly their substance abuse program, and they have really great stats in terms of recidivism and the success of their program, but to what degree do they cherry-pick the people that go through that program? So, you know, I mean, I think it'd be, you know, relevant in terms of the question about who is likely, what criteria do you use for who is likely to reoffend and so on. So, yes.
Any further questions or comments? Representative Gilliam, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, this one actually is for you, do you have any objection or thoughts about smoking?
Light up.
Hold it when you're gambling.
Right. Thank you.
Smoking what?
Anything else? Thanks a lot, Cindy. And thanks for answering our questions so pleasantly.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, and we have a couple of other people listed who I think are not here. They're here. Please identify themselves. With that, thank you very much, committee. I think we've learned a lot today. Representative Whitman.
Madam Chair, I wanted to report to the committee that Chair asked myself and Representative Nathanson to work on the House Bill 3007.
Which is?
The manufactured home park bill that we heard last session. I'd like to report that we've had two meetings, Representative Nathanson and I are co-chairing. We've had two meetings with the stakeholders. Then Representative Nathanson and I have received a detailed briefing by CASA, not the court appointed, it's Community and Shelter Assistance people, what they do and how they do it. We toured a mobile home park in Redmond, which was purchased by the park owners or the tenants. And tomorrow we're having our third meeting, and we hope to submit words to a page and for draft legislation, start at that meeting and finish up. That's what we've done. The question to the chair is, you get three bills. Is this, you hoping this will be one of the bills, so we need to...
That's something I'd like to discuss with you and Representative Nathanson, because I think we have several issues that might be bills, but let's talk about that. We certainly want that to be a bill that will get passed. You've done a lot of work on that, I know. And so, Representative Olson, why don't you report our work on the program integrity work group?
Well, we've been... real snapshot view of it. Representative Gallegos is on it, Chair Tomei, myself, Gene, Representative Witz has been involved as well. And we have met three times now. We're going to meet two more times. Where we're at now is we've really kind of evaluated some of the bills that were proposed that we didn't listen to in committee during this last session, but there are some good ideas there. There's a lot of other good ideas that are out there. We've created a matrix now of ideas that we've explored. We're now going to flesh those out. And there's potentially a couple bills that we may, you know, propose. You know, that's still one of those things that we're just kind of working through right now. But it's a key component to what I've learned anyways is education. Mm-hmm. There's really a lot of misconception out there, and I think you just alluded to one of them, you know, when Cindy was up here a little bit. Then there's other some things for communication seems to be huge for the enforcement side of it within DHS himself, and also for law enforcement outside for that connection. I think, you know, we're having some barriers broken down there. And there's some really good things that are happening right now. So
it's been very, very interesting.
Some happens. And Jill Gray's back there, and she's just been just a little trooper back there.
Indeed, she and Lisa.
She's had to tolerate us.
So, Representative Gillen, what have you been doing during the interim?
Well, I'll talk to you about that later, but tomorrow will be the third iteration of, the first meeting of the third iteration of Elder Abuse Prevention, and I expect a bill for February that addresses definitions in statute around elder abuse prevention, hooking up more closely with 211 and public education about elder abuse prevention, particularly in the financial area. And I'm excited about the task force of the same players that you've all seen, but we've added, Peter Courtney added Canope and Roblin as the Senate representatives, and I'm going to co-chair it with Representative Quill.
Great. Good job. Thank you. Any other reports? Oh, she's reminding me, Representative Whitsett is excused today. Thank you. So I have been working, and I don't think I've worked with any of the legislators, have I, on the secure facility for girls, underage girls, who've been involved in prostitution and finding a secure placement for them. So it's been very exciting. It's a very, very tough slog, but I've been able to work with the U.S. Attorney General, or Oregon's version of that, Amanda Marshall, and even with Ron Wyden came to one of our meetings. He's interested in some federal legislation. He said we are way ahead of any other state that's doing this, so we're very excited about that. Any other reports? All right. Thank you all very much. Christy, it's great to see you. Thank you, Cheyenne. With that, we will close the House Interim Committee on Human Services and Housing.
Sorry, I've been harassed.
Committee on Human Services and Housing.